Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm your host, Darren Bresnitz. I'm heading back to the East Coast today for a chat with Chef Tyler Akin, founder of Form Function Hospitality. We chat about his culinary adventures up and down the Eastern Seaboard, his mentoring of the next generation of chefs, and how he supported the culinary community during the pandemic. And then we head into the archives when we were joined in the studio by singer, songwriter, Monica Heiderman, who performs under the name Heiderman, who tells us about her early love of synthesizers and plays a few songs to show them off. So please sit back, relax, and enjoy Snacky Tunes here on HRN. Tyler, welcome to Snacky Tunes. Appreciate you taking the time out of your schedule just for my digging in alone. I know it's full on right now, so appreciate you sitting down with us.
Thanks for having me, Darren. Esteemed company, really honored and flattered to be here with you.
I mean, speaking of company, let's just go straight to the hometown because I'm from Philly and I just feel like in the first few years of this show, maybe we got a Philly person, you know, things like that. And now I feel, if I look back the last like 10, 20 shows, a quarter of it's Philadelphia people, you know, yourself included. What's going on in the city? Like what's happening there from the ground up?
I mean, it's incredible. When did you leave Philly yourself?
Oh, I left when I graduated high school. I never went back. So it's 2000, but I go back every year. So yeah. I have a good idea. I mean, it's my hometown, so I keep abreast of it. But yeah. You know, it's like, I think the last, you know, Spraga ate there and Fork and Form, which I'm blanking. I'm not saying the right restaurant name, but.
Fork.
You know, it's like, I've checked in, but it's not like it is today.
It's wild, and I'll stop asking you questions now, but.
No, it's fair. You flip the mic around, whatever you want.
I think, just to kind of illustrate the trajectory of the city and its food scene. I mean, I moved to Philly, I guess it was like 2012. And, you know, at the time I had an opportunity, but kind of wanted to, you know, and had convinced myself it was the right thing to do to move up to Philly from DC where I'd been for about 5 years. wanted to be closer to home, in Wilmington for several reasons at the time. But, you know, there were maybe 4 restaurants, maybe 5 restaurants that I felt like I'd really be happy at and would kind of, continue me on the path that I wanted to be on. It was, you know, which isn't to say that, you know, there were more, that I was probably unaware of. Right. But, I had been in DC for a minute and, you know, just kind of looking down from 10,000 feet, like, where am I going to be happy? Where can I keep developing as a cook and a chef? You know, now if I were moving from DC, to Philly, you know, kind of at a similar point in my career as I was then, I would be overwhelmed by the options. Like it's just unbelievable. Like there would be 30 or 40 restaurants that I would be very, very happy taking the next step in my career at, now. And it's just, it's incredible. I mean, you know, on the one hand, that's amazing. It's great for diners. It's great for the community of chefs to know that there's so many of us kind of putting in the work and doing fun and interesting things, pushing the scene forward. But, you know, the flip side of that, like the other edge of that sword, I guess, is, you know, that, and I think it's happened in almost every major market, in the restaurant scene is it, you know, it kind of dilutes the labor pool in a way. You know, right. Yeah. So it's, you know, from an operating standpoint, it creates some challenges. From a consumer standpoint, cultural standpoint, it's like a blessing. It's unbelievable.
Sure. Sure. And it's a diverse amount of owners and operators when I feel like it used to be, you could count them, a lot of restaurants or maybe 4 or 5 restaurateurs who are behind them. And, you know, you mentioned Wilmington, Delaware, which I know is where you grow up. We haven't had, you may be our first chef who's actually from Delaware on the show. And I always felt that like Philly had that New York chip on his shoulder. Does Wilmington, Delaware have the Philly chip on his shoulder? Can Philly actually be a chip on someone's shoulder? Or is that just me, you know, being hopeful about Philadelphia pride?
I think the vibe between Wilmington and Delaware, as somebody who grew up down there, is like I think we, you know, downtown Wilmington has its own thing going on and its own, you know, exciting course that it's on as far as like restaurants are concerned. There's been several cool places open the last few years. Mm-hmm. They're more in the pipeline. Proud to be a part of it. I think, you know, for me growing up, and I'm assuming this is still the case, there's sort of a sense that you're a major suburb of Philly in a way, right? Like, yes, yeah. We have a downtown. Yes, sure. We are a proper kind of small, medium-sized city. But, you know, for us, like, we're all Philadelphia sports fans. When we skipped school in high school, right? It was to go up to South Street and get a Zipperhead and get a cheesesteak and Jim's and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, I think we're in a way maybe honorary Philadelphians, and everybody in Philadelphia who owns a business comes down to Delaware to set up their LLC. So,
yeah. No. I mean, tax haven for all. you know, I know that you, from Wilmington, where you grew up, you went to New York and you were studying law, but you got pulled into the food scene, and you got pulled into the food scene during an interesting time in New York, like one of these really exciting times, but you didn't stay there. You went to DC. Why not stick around and play at this like incredible time in New York? What did DC, or what did you personally want to get out of, you know, the start of your culinary career?
So there's an air gap there in my biography. I actually, I went to NYU for my freshman year, had been recruited to play soccer there. And like, I enjoyed New York a little too much. I mean, I was closing up bars, loved it. I would say I was overwhelmed by the pace and energy, and like the fact that NYU didn't really have a campus to speak of. I kind of came back to University of Delaware with my tail between my legs and finished up down there. And then, you know, followed a girl down to DC who had taken a job down there.
Oh, there you go. There it is. Me too in Austin, buddy. Me too in Austin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know what the hell I was doing with my life at that point.
Sure.
She was from a hospitality family, Chicago originally. And I just kind of caught the bug. I mean, it was like a lot of people, I think, who are my contemporaries, it was a combination of, you know, maybe like, Bourdain was our proximate kind of inspiration. But for me, growing up, food was a big part of our family. You know, my mom cooked dinner every night. My grandmother cooked amazing dinners for holidays. My sister always had like Food Network on, you know, so the early years, like I literally remember, I think like that first episode, I remember watching the first episode of Malta Mario where he mangles his hand on live television live. I don't know if we're allowed to talk about Malta Mario, but I will.
sure.
Three fat ladies, you know, all that stuff. It was grilling and chilling. It was just like a fixture in our living room. So, I knew this might be a cool path for me. I was an athlete. It felt like somewhere I could remain sort of competitive and active, appealed to my ADHD.
Sure.
And I started working for this artisanal bread baker who had set up these crazy spreads at farmers markets down there. And he had a catering division to his business and started gravitating more and more towards that. And at a certain point he said, you should go to culinary school. So I did. There was a very classically French culinary school outside DC called L'Académie de Cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, Carla Hall, Aaron Silverman from Roses, like they have some great graduates.
Yeah.
But it's now defunct, sadly, but it was an incredible place. It was all these ex White House chefs, ex French embassy chefs who, you know, had stories about like knife fights in the kitchen in Lyon in the 70s and,
different time.
Really enjoyed that. Yeah, totally. So yeah, that was, you know, a little more roundabout path back to Philly, but was lucky to spend my first several years cooking with some amazing people down in DC. So great place.
I've always wondered about DC because I feel like New York, the epicenter is like the financial district in many ways and things like that. And LA is obviously Hollywood, but DC is political broker and power players and things like that. And, you know, we are kicking off an election year. What was it like working in DC for all those years? Like, did you feel that ramp up around election years? Was it a different type of clientele than you would expect from other cities? Just because it's such a concentration of one specific, like, you don't get that even in any other East Coast city. It's a very unique conglomerate of people.
It really is. I think that, you know, these defining characteristics of DC, especially the kind of avid dining audience down there, you have like seemingly limitless expense accounts, right?
Yes.
So that's one thing. So they, as a result of that, I think, you know, probably per capita, maybe more compelling restaurants than most other places, you know, because the economy can support it. There was never a recession in DC, right?
Sure.
Like, I was getting into this around the time of the financial crisis of like 2007-08. And I think it took many years for a lot of markets to recover from the effects of that time. DC, on the other hand, like, the money never stopped flowing through lobby shops, through contractors,
sure.
right? So it was a very healthy scene, even in the context of this really like cataclysmic economic condition that most of the country was going through. When I started working at Comey, which was just an incredible and legendary place, that's now taken on a new identity during the pandemic. But Comey was this, you know, I think it was 34 seats at the time. It was a $150 tasting menu, which was, you know, inflation adjusted would probably be a $300 tasting menu now, whatever.
Sure.
It was, you know, and we were full every night. There was no, you
right.
know, granted, small, but. And there were several other restaurants like that. I mean, at the time, there was Citronelle, and there was, you know, some other spots that were like really just doing that format and having no trouble getting butts in seats. You know, by contrast, Philly, in the you know 12 or 13 years I've been here or close by, they're really like. It's a different ethos. It's a different market entirely. Not a lot of tasting menu kind of format restaurants to speak of. You know, some people have even abandoned it recently. Who had done it for a long time. And I don't know. You know, the other thing in DC is it's so transient, right? So
sure.
people that you don't have folks who, you know, except for maybe like the owners of a lobby firm or principals at a law firm, like most people aren't sticking around there for the long haul.
And it empties out over the weekend too.
Often. Yeah. You know, so it for me, like I really like DC. There were aspects of it that I didn't love, but quickly became nostalgic for it when I left. Like I do appreciate trees. For one thing, there's something appealing about the scale of that city, like from a
sure.
verticality sort of standpoint. It's like, it's like a big town, you know. There are more big buildings there than maybe when I lived there, but it's, you know, it has this very like modest scale to it, you know, in the way that much of, you know, New Orleans does, for instance. You know, you're not like looking up at these huge buildings for the most part. There's an appeal to that too, but it's incredible. I mean, every time I go back to DC, there are more great restaurants that have opened in the meantime, you know, and like the trajectory of that city was clearly heading in that direction when I left. And then within a couple of years, there was just an absolute explosion.
Yeah.
You know, by 2015, it was, you know, I was telling people partly just to be kind of controversial, but I was telling people in Philly, I think DC is a better restaurant city than Philly. Here I am in Philly.
There just goes trying Tyler.
To ruffle feathers.
He's talking about DC.
It's an amazing place. And I still have really good friends down there. I will always remember the folks at Comey and Little Sarah so fondly.
Amazing. Well, let's take a quick musical break and we come back. I want to talk about your return to Philly, your opening of your own spots, and your deep love for Pusha T. We have a song from the archives here on Snacky Tunes on HRN. Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. We're here with Tyler Aiken, founder of Form Function Hospitality. So you leave DC, you return to Philly, you're over at Zahav, which, you know, at the time, I mean, still one of, bar none, the best restaurants in the city. And you can pull out from there as well to maybe say the country, East Coast. When did you start thinking that it was time for you to strike out on your own?
Immediately.
When you graduated or like the first time you stepped into a kitchen?
I always wanted to do my own thing. Mm-hmm. I would say I got a little bit of a later start than some people do, right? Because I took these detours through like a year of law school that didn't work out and kind of exploring some other things. So I always had this idea in my head that I would, I wasn't going to be like a lieutenant for a celebrity chef for a decade before I did my thing. I wanted to get out on my own. So, really from the outset, when I got to Philly, I was like on LoopNet and Craigslist and not working with a broker or anything, but just pounding the pavement, looking for services that could accommodate one of the ideas I had kicking around. Like, and this was pretty much right out of the gate. I was on my days off. I was going to look at spaces and, writing, kind of napkin business models and investment pitches to people in my orbit who I think might be able to support that. So yeah, it was right away. Yeah.
What were those first few years like? Did you feel that you had learned enough? Did you feel that actually getting a later start was better than just jumping into it at a younger age? You know, what you know, you never forget your first one. So what was that journey like?
I thought that I knew that I could work hard and I knew I had stamina. I think the dynamic when I think back to Zahav in that era and like what was asked of us day to day, expected of us, you know, kind of who survived those expectations and persevered and stuck around. It was like really, you know, anybody past the Fryer station or like, you know, which is cold, what's cold side as well, was a thoroughbred. I mean, truly, yeah, like it was, we're talking like you had the same level of energy when you got there as you did at, you know, 1 AM when you were mopping and scrubbing. It was just like the competition on that line was,
deep.
It was deep and it was like, it made me, you know, I think the cook that I am. And, I felt like I was, whatever restaurant I was going to do, it was going to be small enough where the stakes weren't so high that I was going to lose anybody a fortune. You know, if it went wrong, I probably wasn't going to be like carrying a bag of debt around for the rest of my life. Smart. I didn't have a family. So smart. I wasn't going to, you know, end up on the streets with, you know, no roof over my kid's head. It was pretty, I would say the stakes were relatively low. All the different things that I was imagining I might do. So I don't know. I felt like I could do it. Yeah. I don't know.
I mean, and it goes well enough that you open up other restaurants and then you start to eye opening back in your hometown of Wilmington. How did you balance it? How do you know when it's time to like, okay, I can open up another spot. I can open up another spot in Philly. I can go to DC and open up another spot. Like, you know, how do you start to get these practices in places and expand while still keeping the same quality?
It's a lot less methodical than I think you might be implying with that question. You know, to some extent, it's like an opportunity falls in your lap and it makes, you know, mathematical sense. You feel like that last place is stable enough now in terms of revenue and staffing that you're not going to pull the rug out from underneath yourself by doing something else. You know, these places that I had in Philly, and by the way, I closed all three of them during the pandemic. They were small enough that, you know, it was never unthinkable to like grab another opportunity. And it was even, I would argue, like by necessity when I think back and in retrospect, I'm like, you know, there's only so much, even if your 20 seat restaurant is busy every night, if you don't have liquor margins and you know, you're running a decent amount of your revenues through delivery services, right? Because you don't have the seats that can produce, you know, the amount of money that the restaurant needs to generate. So you're looking outside to other arrows pointing in, you're linking up with delivery services. And, you know, it's like, unless you are literally there, baked into the business model 7 days a week, you kind of have to do more things, you know, to provide in advance, you know. And I think that began to feel especially urgent when I had my first daughter.
Kids will change the whole equation. So you mentioned having to close your restaurants during the pandemic, and I don't want to jump too far ahead, but I know that 2020 was an especially big year for you because that's when you end up opening up your first spot in Wilmington at the Hotel DuPont, and the pandemic hits and you're making all these decisions. And so you're starting this new venture, you're closing these new spots, like emotionally in the headspace, like what were you in? Because on the other side, if that wasn't enough, you also get involved with the IRC and you're helping to like lobby. And even though you're juggling your own businesses, like helping other people, like take us back to that time. And how did you prioritize, you know, what you need to do to survive and what you need to do to help the larger community?
Yeah. Things kind of work out the way they're supposed to,
sure.
I guess. I think about that time. And by the way, it was not the plan to close these restaurants in Philly. I was proud of them.
Sure.
They were stable, you know, if not throwing off profits that were going to make anybody rich. Like it was
enough.
They were in their own ways, like beloved by their respective neighborhoods. You know, I had teams that I personally valued and loved. And it was, you know, I saw the promised land, right? Like I had this thing at Hotel DuPont. It was the first project that I had done that was really properly developed, you know, where there was like a branding exercise with a branding agency. There was PR involved. There was, you know, I'd always been kind of like punk rock DIY, like I'll never have a publicist. I'm now married to a publicist, by the way, and I love her and she makes this all possible. But it was like an architect, a general contractor. I mean, I had done restaurant projects where we should have had a GC and we should have had permits, but we just put paper up over the windows and did the work quietly. So it was like, okay, this is like the real deal. I made it. It's a 150 seat restaurant coming online. It's going to produce enough revenue that I can start having people around me who can help me kind of like run around between these places. And that was the challenge of those little spots, is like the little places, they have all the problems that a big restaurant has.
Of course.
You just can't really afford the right amount of management to help you deal with all those issues. Right. So it was just like chaos all the time. Always something on fire. And, you know, I'm like, okay, so March 1st, 2020, if you ask me, how are things going? I'm like, they're going great.
Yeah.
I'm about to open this place down at the Hotel DuPont in May. And I'm like thinking about what's going to be behind it. And then the shit hit the fan. And all of a sudden, you know, three laid off teams. There was no knowing when the Hotel DuPont was actually going to open, right? Because
sure.
You know, we have furniture coming from France. We have upholstery coming from New Jersey. We have millwork coming from PA. And at that time, you know, you couldn't even cross state lines with like manufactured components to put a restaurant together. So it was like, really for me, jarring. I got super depressed. My outlet was, I think the IRC was like my release valve, right? It was the connection with other people around the country who, you know, some of them had 20 restaurants that each grossed $10 million a year. And then there was me with three restaurants that in total, you know, grossed, $2 or $3 million a year, right? So it's like people, all different scales, all different experiences, backgrounds. And, you know, it wasn't just commiserating. It was like solution oriented. We were in the trenches together, making the calls that we could, working every angle we could to try to find some relief for restaurants. It's funny, I listened earlier to the interview you did with David Neufeld in May of 21.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, May of 21, we were already over a year into this thing at that point. And that was almost 3 years ago now.
Today. Just because the doors are open doesn't mean that people have fully recovered. And I think that's one of the biggest things that people miss about this, is that it's still a journey back to what it was.
I got super depressed. I mean, I think I've always had a tendency towards like depressive kind of thoughts and sort of self-destructive behavior at times. And in that moment, I was just, you know, the restaurants were either dormant or in some state of kind of partial operation. And I was drinking a lot and, I wasn't happy. I was panicking and, you know, some of those friendships I made through the IRC are enduring ones. And, I think, and furthermore, I was able to try something new, in the form of therapy that and Gia, my wife, like really facilitated that. And you know, she was incredibly patient. I think back to like what a mess I was at that time on a personal level. And just the grace and patience that she showed towards me was just astonishing. I have to say, and I know that some restaurant groups and restaurants have implemented programs that give people access to therapy. And we all know how endemic like the substance abuse issue is in our industry. But for me, like therapy, being able to talk to somebody and start to work through some of this stuff, like really saved me in a way. Mm-hmm. I feel like if, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, I would have felt like that was a really self-indulgent thing to say that, I'd rather stiff upper lip this thing and like, sure, white knuckle it. And let's just work our 80-hour weeks and, keep moving. But, it was, you know, that was part of the mixed bag. It's like, it gives you an opportunity to slow down and think about what you're doing and where you want to go in life. And, I'm really grateful for that episode. As hard as it was, I think about it, I'm like, I feel good. I feel good today.
I mean, thank you for sharing, and it's a beautiful sentiment. And you know, I love that you and other chefs have become so open about this stuff. And I know that you're passing that new mindset, the new outlook to the next generation of chefs through mentoring and things like that. And I have to imagine, I know that talking to chefs that coming up even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, like you said, like there was no like, how are you feeling? Literally not how you're feeling. It's just like, are you ready to work? And if you're not, I mean, how has it been chatting with the new generation of chefs and prepping them for like what their lives are going to be and how to balance it in a way that maybe you didn't have that guidance when you were coming up?
Yeah. I mean, I'll speak in kind of broad terms here because I've had conversation with folks and I don't want to compromise their, their right to privacy. But I think, there is an openness and a tolerance towards, some of these issues that has emerged that is an incredibly positive thing. For a long time, it was just kind of the elephant in the corner, right? And even more than that, even more than being an elephant in the corner, like an unspoken reality that we all knew about, you know, it was almost a badge of honor. It's like,
that's what it was. Yeah.
You know, like,
elephant on your chest, not in the corner.
Yeah, dude. Like, I'm about to like do a 16-hour day with 300 covers tonight. I'm going to prep the shit out of it. Not only that, I'm going to leave you a mountain of fucking prep tomorrow that you can sell behind me. And guess what? I drank like,
a quart,
I drank a fifth of whiskey, 10 beers and, whatever last night. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe it was more than that. So, that was like, that was kind of, and I'm sure in some places this is still the case, but I think less and less so. And that's a good thing.
I agree. I think it's just, going in with a mindset from the start and then making a business plan that also matches that mindset because there's restaurants in Philly that like we're open Monday through Friday. We're not open Saturday and Sunday. And there's just, I think part of what the pandemic allowed for is mentally and even comparatively allowing chefs and restaurants to be what they want to be. And no one's saying like, oh, you're not doing Saturday, Full House, two PDRs, 3 hours of sleep. It's like, cool, you're open from Monday to Thursday, you're doing lunch and breakfast, and then you're doing family time on the weekend. And everyone's like, sounds great. I'm in. Like, congrats to you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, I think that's fantastic. I think the competing dynamic there is, you know, they're, if that's how you want to run your business, if exactly. that's a model that you want, that's fantastic. If you can make that work, like, more power to you. You know, if you can find a way to set your business up so that you don't have to be there 100% of the time, and you can actually like not miss your child's entire childhood, that's incredible.
If you could kiss it in the morning or at night or even both,
yeah,
wonderful.
Right. Wonderful. You know, but there's still this kind of like lingering.
I know.
There's this lingering expectation, I think, in certain corners of food media, especially critical food media, that like, if you're not doing that like 40 seat passion project, and when I pop in anonymously, if you're not there like sweating on the line each of the three times that I come before I write the review, you know, there's this, it's kind of like glorifying the alcohol and the drug use in a way, right? Where it's, you know, there's this view again in certain quarters of the food media where it's like, I want to see you struggling. I want to get the sense that like, if you're not here, the business model doesn't work. I want to feel like if you're, if I don't, you know, if I don't see you here all the time, like this isn't the restaurant that I need it to be to kind of anoint it in the way that I can. And I think that what that leads to often is, you know, chefs, restaurateurs becoming like trapped in these really small places where, and it's like, okay, well, I can expand, but if I expand, I'm not going to be at that place all the time anymore. And then if that guy shows up and I'm not there, like, he's going to think that I'm phoning it in.
Yeah. I mean, the tough thing is that you can turn your back on it, but as we all know, those lists and being on, you know, the national best new chef or restaurant or things like that drives a lot of business, and it's a double-edged sword.
Of course, you know, I love the energy and the adrenaline rush of being in the kitchen, of being in the restaurant as much as anybody. I also really love being with my kids. So when I look at an opportunity, I'm not looking at just like, what is this going to do for me and my family financially? What is this going to do for, you know, my reputation or my ability to kind of get on a fresh list? It's, you know, the primary, criterion for me is, you know, can I do this project and still have time with my family? Exactly. That's it.
Now, look, you have a new project opening up, Bastia in Philly this year. And, you know, the menu looks great. I'm super excited about it. But what I'd love to actually talk about is creating playlists for each of your spot, because this is now the sixth spot that you've opened. And, you know, they can't all have the same music, and they can't all have Pusha T, which I know that you love. But how do you make a playlist? What's the vibe? Like, how do you set it, especially for the new spots? And then how long does it take to really dial it in?
So I have to admit, you know, we were the first three restaurants, the little places I had in Philly. It was like, you know, Spotify account,
sure,
family account.
Love it.
Each location, you know, was in theory a user. Occasionally you get these kind of like cease and desist type letters from BMG or whatever it is, right? Where they've identified your streaming activities associated with a business address. I was, you know, again, in that kind of like punk rock, like
pirate ship type of stuff,
whatever mode, right? Yeah, it was a pirate ship. You know, it was figuring out, honestly, so I told you I worked for Johnny Moniz down in D.C., who had Comey and Little Cerro. They had the coolest musical direction, and his wife, Ann Marler, was largely the source of this. Just super distinctive, like, yes, eclectic, but it all made sense. You know, there was an arc to the playlist. And that's something that is really interesting to me, especially now that I've the last few projects have been like all day type operations, right? So there's like, there needs to be an arc throughout the day that is sensitive to what time of day you're active, but also within that meal period, there needs to be an arc, right? So like, you're not going to play the same music when the first few people are walking in at 5 o'clock as when the restaurant's bumping at 8 o'clock, you know, on a Friday or Saturday night. There needs to be a build, a crescendo. I think that when you're getting close to that crescendo is when there's really more opportunity to get eclectic and, and kind of play with different genres and just kind of maybe you're tying it together with a, you know, the, your constant is this like incrementally increasing beat per minute or maybe there's some kind of like funny connection that you're trying to make in a subtle way between one artist or one genre and another. I have to give huge props to a company called Gravy. Not sure if you're familiar with them, but what they do is a lot of that legwork that I, you know, used to do myself or with the help of some trusted colleagues. This is a service that, you know, they handle the licensing, so you're not going to get those cease and desist letters anymore. And it's actual people. It's not like, you know, kind of an algorithm. It's not like a, it's not a, you know, a Muzak kind of algorithm that's spitting out a playlist for you. These are like real people. They're true music nerds who staff this company.
Awesome.
And you can call them, like, if you have a special event and you think that what's going to match that event. I feel like I'm doing an advertisement right now and apologize, but everybody should know about Gravy because they're really amazing. You'd be like, I got this thing coming in. Like they, you know, they're, this is the vibe and this is the food that they want served. And I'm thinking that like some, like we can lean into the Rat Pack tonight or, you know what I mean? Right. Like let's do a tonight. Like they will turn around a playlist of that for you quickly. And not only is it there for you? It's sick. Like it, I couldn't have done a better job myself. So huge fan of them. And as I have, you know, had myself become spread a little more thin, I love like having competent partners who are really, really good at what they do. I used to try to own everything. And now, you know, it's, I see more and more like the utility in having longer, deeper relationships with people who are much better at doing that thing than you are.
How you get better yourself. You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Tyler, I can't thank you enough for making the time and sharing so much with us. If people want to check out the restaurants or hospitality group, or just follow along with your adventures, where can they go?
So, upcoming restaurant at Bastia Fishtown, right? So that's going to be in a 50-room boutique hotel in Fishtown. At Le Cavalier, DE is the restaurant at Hotel DuPont in Wilmington. I'm at Tyler_Aiken. I'm only on Instagram, really. I'm not TikToking or tweeting.
It's fine. It's, you know. Well, thank you so much. Thank you to Bailey for setting this up. We have another song from the archives. And then a live performance here on Snacky Tunes on HRN.
This episode is supported by HRN business member, Itani Ramen, Chef Kyle Itani's expression of Japanese dining culture located in Oakland, California. At Itani, Kyle explores Japan's rich culture, focusing on traditional flavor profiles and offering an izakaya experience made up of a diversity of small bites, donburi bowls, cocktails, and plenty of ramen. Itani's sister restaurant located next door, Yonsei Hand Rolls, serves open-faced Japanese sushi hand rolls made of crisp nori, seasoned sushi rice, and top-notch fish. Itani Ramen and Yonsei Hand Rolls support HRN's creative, educational reporting and storytelling that drives conversation to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place.
I am one half your host, Snackytunes, Greg Brusnitz. We have Heidemann, a.k.a. Monica H., live in studio. Thanks. Big shout out to Andrew J6, as he is in our
phone. Andrew from J6.
I don't even know if he associates that, but that's how he is in our phone.
Yeah, we both realize we both have him in our phone that way.
Yeah.
Many bands ago.
Speaking of many bands ago, you've had many, many bands.
I have.
You want to rattle off some of the former projects?
Currently, I have this project, and then I also play synth in the Wall McLean, and also Hess is More, a great band from Denmark, and also half the time in New York. I was in a pop band called Xylos, where I was singing, and then before that, I had kind of a solo, kind of proggy, jazzy rock thing under my own name once again.
So you started 10 years ago, you were saying, with your own name project, and now you've dropped the first name, and you're just going by a last name.
Mm-hmm.
What was the decision to, or is there any tie between the former project and the current project, or is it just in name only?
Just in name. You know, my cells regenerated, so I got a new name.
Let's just talk about Wall McLean for like half a second.
Yeah.
Because I saw you play at what is now another defunct venue, Cameo.
Oh, yeah.
That show was amazing.
Oh, yeah. Which one did you go to? The last one or one of the first ones?
The last one.
Oh, great.
I was out sick and was like, I will just like try to make it for the second one. It was great. That new record is great, and the band put together is awesome.
Yeah, it's been great playing with them.
So let's talk about the current project and how do, you know, the songs kind of come together? Like, where do you pull the inspiration from for this, kind of given 10 years of synth playing and your history?
Well, I think it really came from playing in bands for so long, and I never really got to create things on my own. Mm-hmm. Either out of thinking that I couldn't or just not wanting to or not even thinking about it, really. And I think after... What's that?
I was going to say, why did you think you couldn't?
I think because at the time I wasn't like super into electronic stuff or production, and I was just more like, oh, I'm a singer. Mm-hmm. And I like synths, but like I was more focused on like being a singer, I guess, and like writing songs, and I would write with bass or bass synth a lot, and like have a lot of make connections with like harmony and bass lines and melody and stuff, but I never got into the technical aspects of it until I kind of decided that I wanted to, and it, of course there's like a learning curve involved to get past the technical stuff, but I just kind of like broke my brain against it for a couple years.
It's amazing.
Still am. But yeah.
But it's amazing how people feel like, you know, I'm too old or
right,
I can't do that. And then you just kind of put like one little small foot in front of the other. And
yeah,
you're like, oh, I learned this synth or I learned this like arpeggiator or,
yeah,
or like anything. So,
yeah, I think also, I mean, I've always like loved synth since I was a child. And, I just never, they kind of intimidated me, to be honest. Like, once I actually had, like, a real one in front of me.
What was the first one that you kind of broke your head against but felt that you mastered?
The first synth that I got was the Korg Poly 800, which actually isn't, like, the easiest synth to really learn as far as
like you started on medium.
Yeah. It was like a, you know, a relatively inexpensive or a inexpensive synth, but to program that is sort of a huge pain in the ass, and it's not a very good synth to mess with in a live setting. It's more of those kind of synths that you just find your sound and like hope and then go with that for whatever song. I mean, unless you mod it and get all crazy with that, but I haven't done that yet.
I mean, there's still more to learn.
It seems endless.
Yeah.
And there's the whole modular world, which is really like taking off and has taken off. And
how did you teach yourself, or where did you start?
I had, you know, some friends. I would ask them things and annoy the shit out of them, and I literally like couldn't understand it. Like there was like certain concepts of it just like would not integrate themselves in my brain, and I was just like, oh my god, why can't I learn this? And I felt really stupid. And then like I just would remember just like staring at a synth and like all the and then all of a sudden like this thing just like opens up in your brain, and it's like this huge epiphany on like how it works, and you're like, oh my god, I can get this now. And then there's like another thing, another layer, and it keeps like going and going.
Can we hear a song?
Sure.
See how effortless that was?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us first?
I'm going to play a song off my newish EP. It's called So In Love. I'm So In Love.
Keep here often just to break the glass.
So you mentioned that you have loved synths since childhood. Mm-hmm. What is it that grabbed you about them before, you know, you loved them before you understood them?
Yes. What I just knew.
What was it that spoke to you?
I don't really know. It's just the sound, you know, like a sound just gets to you. And I think a lot of it, like I watched a lot of music videos when I was a kid from the 80s, and like I used to like have to watch like the MTV Top 10 video countdown, like at the end of the week, every week. And you know, at the time, there's like all these bands with synths and a lot of like DX7s and Casios and stuff. And there was just something about the sound. And I just remember like wanting one so badly for Christmas. And I was taking piano lessons and when I was a kid, and I was like, oh, I want like a Casio for, you know, for some reason that was like the name that stood out probably from some music video. And I remember my dad got me a Casio, but it was like one of those kind of like Casio tone, like with like the program beats. And
I think we still have one in our attic.
Yeah, I still have mine too. Just like in very, my dad's attic. But I remember
where
being
all Casio
really
tones
bummed
go
out.
To die.
Yeah, no, I remember like even in fourth grade being like playing it and like being like, that's not the sound that I want. Like I wanted like waves and stuff. I wanted like sawtooths and square, and you know,
totally.
But I didn't know that I wanted that. Right. I just remember like being like, oh, electric piano. Like this is not
what
like I
the,
wanted.
The rumba beat.
Yeah. Tango, rumba, salsa, two step.
Yeah. Just, you're like, this is not what I envisioned.
Yeah. No, not at all. And I just remember being like, and I didn't understand why I was so bummed. Cause I didn't have anyone else. My parents are like, I mean, they were into music, but they're like into kind of classical music, and they're like immigrants and didn't like weren't exposed to, you know, rock that much or pop, you know.
Who were some of the bands that influenced you kind of early on?
Pretty much just pop bands. Nothing too obscure. I think like my favorite albums were like Cyndi Lauper, She's So Unusual. That was like a big one. Madonna, pretty classic.
I know. Sorry for the distraction. There's a huge surprise birthday party going on in the background.
Simultaneously.
You're doing. I mean,
they're not clapping for.
They're like Madonna.
My childhood choices.
Cyndi Lauper. Oh my god.
I agree.
Oh yes, of course. She was amazing. She got robbed that Friday. Should've been number one.
Seriously, most underrated pop star.
Can we hear another song?
Sure.
What are you gonna play for us this time?
This one is called Swords, and it's from my first EP called Orphan.
Everyone knows it will destroy you.
So EP came out earlier this spring.
Yes, in April.
Congratulations.
The second one, yeah.
What's up for, I guess summer's almost done. So I guess what's up for the fall? Man, that's like heartbreaking that summer's almost done.
I know, like got all of a sudden cold. Not cold, but yeah. Like, you know, a balmy 80.
Yeah.
this week, and you can kind of feel the cold.
Yeah, you can feel
the fall,
like,
creeping in.
Yeah. That's okay. How's your fall clothing game?
Well, I'm going to LA. I'm going to try and keep it alive, keeping summer alive.
Like, I refuse to pack any jackets. It's just shorts,
yes,
tank tops.
Exactly.
So, LA, any shows coming up?
Yeah, actually, I have one at Come On Everybody.
Oh, amazing.
Mm-hmm. When? September 1st.
Oh, perfect.
So, yeah.
Great.
You should come.
Yeah, of course. Who else is playing?
My friend... is playing, she goes by the name Trash Magnolia. She's it's kind of like electronic, bouncy New Orleans, but not jazzy,
yeah,
but electronic with a trashy overtones.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
That actually sounds really
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, she's an old friend of mine and she's amazing. So,
is she from New Orleans or?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh. Okay, good to know.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Well, we'll make sure we have time for one more song. Where can people find your two EPs? Where can they find you on
the usuals?
The usual places.
I mean, if you want a physical copy, you can go to Bandcamp, but you know, Spotify, iTunes, etc.
Can we talk about Bandcamp for a second?
Yeah, yeah.
They are great.
Thank you. I love them.
Yeah. They are, I feel like, super underrated.
Yeah.
But I feel they probably more than most have done a really good job for making a lot of the bands that we book on here, like, direct kind of, like, access to them and to learn their music and discover a lot of stuff.
Yeah. No, it's great. And, like, for, you know, like, people don't really buy physical stuff anymore, but, like, for an online store for that kind of thing. And if you don't have some major distributor doing that for you, and it's like amazing
because yeah.
you know you just go direct and
it's awesome. And there's also a lot of bands that do fun stuff, like people sell cassettes. You get the digital and you get the cassette.
Yeah,
but I don't have a cassette player, but you know.
Oh, you don't?
No,
I have a couple I can give you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I might have one. It might be in the Casio, next to Casio.
Oh,
the
yeah,
attic.
It's probably in the
probably.
Same.
Probably in the same kind of like.
Same department.
Yeah,
in
the
your
same
attic.
The same sad place of departed electronics that went for the 80s. Well, thank you for coming on.
Yeah, yeah.
Big shout out to the Codobo guys. Thank you to Mr. Andrew Raposo.
Of course.
Wherever he might be. Shout out to the family, to Meatball, to Ornella. Thanks to Pierre for stepping in today. It was great, man. Dave, hope you had a good time in Philly. We will be back next week with another episode of Snacky Tunes. What's the name of the last song you're going to play for us?
This one's called My Pet, and it's on the new EP that just came out.
Okay. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.
Snacky Tunes is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.